So we're back in 2 Samuel and chapter 17, and we've got as far as verse 5, and all this, these enemies of David, of Ziba and Shimei and Ahithophel, and now we have a friend of David called Hushai. And Hushai comes along, and Absalom calls Hushai, verse 5, for advice. And verse 7, Hushai said to Absalom, "The advice that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time. For," said Hushai, "you know your father and his men, that they are mighty men, that they are enraged in their minds, and like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field, and your father is a man of war and will not camp with the people. Surely by now he is hidden in some pit or in some other place. And it will be when some of them are overthrown at the first that whoever hears it will say, 'There is a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom.' And he, even he who is valiant, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will melt completely. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and those who are with him are valiant men. Therefore I advise that all Israel be fully gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba, like the sand that is by the sea for multitude, and that you go to battle in person. So we will come upon him in some place where he may be found, and we will fall on him as the dew falls on the ground, and of him all the men who are with him, there shall not be left so much as one. Moreover, if he has withdrawn into a city, then all Israel shall bring ropes to that city. We will pull it into the river until there is not one small stone found there." So Absalom and all the men of Israel said, "The advice of Hushai the Archite is better than the advice of Ahithophel. For the Lord had purposed to defeat the good advice of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring disaster on Absalom." Then Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, do you remember from chapter 15 that David had sent them back into the city in essence to act as spies? "Thus and so Ahithophel advised Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus and so I have advised. Now therefore send quickly and tell David, saying, 'Do not spend this night in the plains of the wilderness, but speedily cross over, lest the king and all the people who are with him be swallowed up.'" And this message gets back to David. So in essence, just to summarize, Hushai is basically buying time for David. And he's saying, he's saying to Absalom, well, don't risk dashing off after him now. You might never find him, but bide your time. Gather together a large army. And once you've done that, go and get David, and then you'll be sure of finding him. But don't go yet. Make sure you're ready and prepared first of all. So he buys David some time, but David has to use that time to travel, verse 16. "Do not spend this night in the plains of the wilderness, but speedily cross over." He's talking about cross over the River Jordan. You must get to the River Jordan tonight, otherwise you'll be finished. That is basically the advice that he's given with all that is there. So, that's enough context for us to go to our psalm, which is Psalm 63. So, this is a psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah. It's page 512. So, a psalm almost certainly written that night when David was told, "Do not spend this night in the plains of the wilderness, but speedily cross over." So that's the kind of time that we're talking about, when he was in the wilderness, dashing through the wilderness, trying to reach the Jordan River. "O God, you are my God. Early will I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. So I have looked for you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory. Because your loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise you. Thus I will bless you while I live. I will lift up my hands in your name. My soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth shall praise you with joyful lips. When I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches, because you have been my help. Therefore, in the shadow of your wings I will rejoice. My soul follows close behind you. Your right hand upholds me. But those who seek my life to destroy it shall go into the lower parts of the earth. They shall fall by the sword. They shall be a portion for the jackals. But the king shall rejoice in God. Everyone who swears by him shall glory. But the mouth of those who speak lies shall be stopped. Well, many of you perhaps will be familiar with Psalm 63 and familiar with all the wonderful praise that's there at the beginning of the psalm. Perhaps some of you have memorized the psalm in years gone by, or perhaps in the authorized version, and you'd be able to quote many of the verses back. Even I was had a temptation to slip into the authorized version as I was reading it there, so familiar as some of those words to us. But it's a glorious psalm, isn't it? It's a psalm, one of the commentators instead said it may have been equaled, but probably not surpassed in terms of its praise to God. And it's remarkable when you read the story in 2 Samuel, as we have done together, and find out the circumstances in which it was written. That really does make the psalm, I think, even more remarkable than ever. And I think it's a wonderful illustration for us of the simple fact that very often when we're at our lowest, it's then that God is closest to us. Now, I don't know if David felt that closeness to God, at least in the opening verses, because he talks about my soul thirsting for you, my flesh longing for you. He says, verse 2, that I've looked for you. So that there seems to be this distance between him and God. And yet there's this wonderful God-centeredness in all that he says. And I think it's this illustration that when we're at our rock bottom, it's then that God is closest to us, even if we don't acknowledge it or know it at the time. Illustration of the footsteps along the beach is not one that's in the Bible, and therefore not a picture that we should necessarily view as, well, we shouldn't view as authoritative, but I think it does illustrate a biblical truth. I'm sure you know that it was a poster, wasn't it, just called Footsteps, and the idea was that somebody saw their life sort of flashing between them, as it were, and as this was going on, they saw these two footprints going along on the beach, sometimes further apart, sometimes closer together. And the person, that's supposed to be an illustration of God walking through life with this person. At the end of his life, the person looks back and says to God, well, I can see how in which you were with me so much of the way, but it seems to be that at the most difficult moments, it was then that you left me, because there was only one set of footprints. And the answer that God gives in this man-made poem is that it was then that I carried you. And I think there's a little bit of that in this Psalm 63. David really is, in some ways, humanly speaking, an absolute rock bottom. He's known what it's like to be chased all around the countryside before he was king. He's known what that's like. But to do so now he is king. To do so now because of his own son who's risen up against him. To do so with all the responsibilities. To do so as an older man. Then surely that's quite different, to face these difficulties and these problems at that stage in his life. Far harder then than perhaps it ever had been before, difficult though it was. And yet, in that desperate, desperate situation where he's in a literal wilderness, I've never been to Israel or to Judah, but I do have some DVDs at home of different parts showing you what it's like now in various parts. And the wilderness, it really is. I mean, it's a desert. There's just nothing there. It's apparently a very, very hot place, and certainly not a place where I would be very comfortable at all. It was bad enough today, and I just wanted to get into the shade. I would have been useless in this situation. But it's a desert, and David's got to get across this desert to the River Jordan on this long march through the day. And it's in those circumstances that he manages to look to God, and in such a glorious way. So three things that I want to say to you from Psalm 63. I've stolen these from a commentator because they were good headings and they all had a bit of alliteration, so I couldn't improve on them. Verses 1 to 4, God, my desire. Verses 5 to 8, God, my delight. And verses 9 to 11, God, my defense. God, my desire. God, my delight. God, my defense. So first of all, God, my desire. And what I like best about verses 1 to 4 is the way in which David seems to be looking at his external situation, which seems so dark and bleak and desperate. He's in a desert, for crying out loud, and he's got all these problems, and he's in such a difficult situation, and he uses those very things in order to focus his prayer on God. Do you notice that? My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. So he's producing metaphors from the very things that are causing him difficulty. And I think there's just a glorious help in this. That so often when we're in difficulty and distress and trouble, we can do one of two things, and they're both usually the wrong thing to do. One thing that we might do is kind of pretend that all the difficulties and problems we are not actually having. Maybe you know people like that. It doesn't matter what the situation is, they'll have a big smile on their face and they'll go around as if there's no problem in the world at all. And yet you know they're going through awful difficulties and awful troubles, and there seems to be just a big gap between them and reality. They seem not just to be aware of what's around them. And not coming to terms with the situation they're in. That's usually the wrong approach. And yet the other situation that very often we choose as an opposite to that is that we get so involved and cast down by our difficulties and problems that our difficulties and problems overwhelm us, and we can't see a way out, and we can't see God through the problems, and we have the opposite problem. We're downcast and miserable, and everything seems as though it's going wrong. But what David does here is that he uses his difficulties and problems as a launching pad to bring him closer to God. And that is the biblical response. It's always the biblical response to problems. We don't pretend they're not there. We don't carry on as if there is no difficulty. But we use our difficulties and problems as a launching pad to bring us to God. And David demonstrates that in a wonderful way. He takes his thirst and his tiredness and his physical weariness and uses them as metaphors to bring his needs before God, to bring his spiritual needs before God. And he says here, O God, you are my God. Early will I seek you, or earnestly will I seek you. Well, David, of course, is not getting very much sleep at the moment. So certainly is seeking God early in the morning. But I think that's a practice of David, not just because of the forced march. And then verse 2, I have looked for you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory, because your loving kindness is better than life. Now here again, David is in the wilderness of Judah. He's far from Jerusalem. He's perhaps looking back to a time maybe when he could be being able to view the tabernacle and to see something of the power and the glory there. But I think he's saying something beside that. I think he's acknowledging, as he did when he sent the Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem, that actually anywhere that God is holy ground. Not just this tent in the city, but actually here, right now, in the wilderness of Judah, God is here. This is his sanctuary as much as anywhere else. Now, obviously, for David in his time, in these Old Testament days, the temple, the tabernacle, was clearly a crucial sign of God's presence. But God did meet with people outside the tabernacle, as we see on many occasions, and as I believe he's doing with David here. God is meeting with him, despite the priests not being there, despite the Ark of the Covenant not being there. And all of that is a foretaste of how it is for us. This is another of the glorious Psalms, because as we look through David, we see David in some ways as a precursor to what it means to be a New Testament believer. He was so blessed, so privileged in Old Testament terms, as a king, as somebody who was close to God, as somebody who was inspired to sing these praises to God. He was a precursor for all New Testament believers in many different ways. And here, I think, is a way in which he explains that and helps us to see that. That he doesn't have to go to the tabernacle to find God. Just as we don't have to go to Jerusalem or to Mecca or wherever it is that men go nowadays. But God meets with us where we are, and we see his power and glory. And why did David look for God? Well, because your loving kindness is better than life, verse 3. My lips shall praise you. Thus I will bless you while I live. I lift up my hands in your name. And really all I want to say about verses 3 and 4 is exactly the same as I've said almost every week on a Wednesday night, is that David praises God before his situation gets better. We must hang on to this. David praises God before his situation gets better. Now, he's not one of these people with a big smile on his face who pretends that his problems don't exist. Verses 1 and 2 demonstrate to us. But he's being very biblical in his response. He understands his problems, but he understands his God. And when we can hold those two things together, as David seems so able to do in all of these Psalms, if we can hold together our problems and God and view them together, then our perspective on life will be all the better. And we will be a balanced Christian. And we will be able to deal with the difficulties and the troubles that life faces at us. And you and I are just so easily swayed into one direction or the other, and find it very difficult to walk that tightrope, as it were, of keeping both our problems and God in balance. And we find, imagine the tightrope walker with his little rod in front of him, we find our rod weighed down on one side or the other, threatening to throw us off the rope. But David holds both things together. And all of this means that then, for he has a great desire for God, because if I can put it like this, the balance is starting to shift a bit. His problems are getting greater and greater and greater, and it couldn't really get much worse for David. So what's the solution? Well, if his problems are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and if what he needs to do is to keep his God and his problems in balance, what does he need to do? Well, his God needs to get bigger and bigger and bigger, if I can put it like that. So he needs more of God than he's had before. And this is the glory of suffering that we've been learning from James. It's that when we are struggling, we are having tough times, it leads us, it gives us this desire to know more of God. There's nowhere else to turn. Nobody else can solve our problems. Nobody else can be a comfort in the way that he is a comfort. No one else loves us in the way that he loves us. Nobody else demonstrates compassion and care in the way that he demonstrates compassion and care. And when he keeps us, even though the whole world is against us, as it must have seemed to David, then God just becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. Or at least it appears that way. God, of course, doesn't change. But it appears to us as though he's bigger, because we realize afresh just his power and his glory, as David says in verse 2. So he praises God in anticipation of what God will do, and he praises God because that's his great desire. So God, my desire, verses 1 to 4. Secondly, verses 5 to 8, God, my delight. God, my delight. Now here's a wonderful step that, again, David seems to make so often. Nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. He's still in the wilderness. Absalom's still pursuing him. Things are still dark and difficult and problematic. Nothing's changed. But he goes from verse 1, my soul thirsts for you, to verse 5, my soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness, without barely a blink. Now, David again is a wonderful example in how we should live. And frankly, every time or so often as I read the Psalms, you start to realize your own inadequacies compared to some of these men of God. David certainly was had feet of clay, and yet in many ways he is somebody to be admired and followed. So here he goes from my soul thirst for you in verse 1 to my soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness. Now you might seem to you and I as though that's a contradiction, but to David it, it's not a contradiction at all, because David knows that God is with him whatever his circumstances. David knows that God is with him even when it feels as though God is not with him. David knows that even when his soul is thirsting, even then he is confident that his soul shall be satisfied, because he understands the promises of God. He knows that God is with him as the king of the people. He has that assurance, as it were. And because he has that assurance, then he can pray, "My soul thirst for you," and at the very same time pray, "My soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness." He's got this wonderful, glorious, childlike confidence in God that every one of us ought to have, but so often we find difficult. "My mouth shall praise you with joyful lips," an echo of verse 3. And then verse 6, "When I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches." So here's David, and he's trekking across the wilderness of Judah with all these other people who are going along with him. He's not really able to stop. He's got to get to the River Jordan. He's got to get there that night, we're told, in 2 Samuel. And he's getting these very fitful sleeps. He's on a march. Maybe he's just getting 20 minutes or an hour here and there. And that's all the sleep he's getting. And even during that time, even then, he remembers God as he lies on his bed, and he meditates on you, on him, in those night watches. Now, we said last time around, you remember we were dealing with Psalm 3 last time around, a psalm written at a very similar period, as the title shows. And verse 5 says, "I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people." And we said when we looked at Psalm 3 of what a glorious blessing it was to be able to lay down and sleep at night without having to worry. And despite, even if there were 10,000 people against us, to be able to, as David did on in Psalm 3, to be able to lay down and sleep, knowing that God is with you, knowing that there's no need to be afraid, to have confidence in God, is a glorious blessing, and maybe one that we ought to pray for if it's not a blessing that we experience. Now, all of that is absolutely true. I don't take any of that back that I said, but we do need to understand that in the context of verse 6 of Psalm 63 as well. "I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches. Because you have been my help, therefore in the shadow of the wings I will rejoice." So clearly in Psalm 63, which is probably only 24 hours after Psalm 3, it was sort of a 2 or 3 day march this that David was on, and probably only 24 hours later, David now is remembering God on his bed. He's meditating on him in the night watches. That doesn't contradict what I've said before. But what it is saying is that in Psalm 63, with the speed of the movement and the necessity of how things were going, David simply was awake. It's as simple as that. What did he do whilst he was awake? Well, he did the same thing, if I can put it like this, as he did in Psalm 3 when he was asleep. He trusted and had confidence in God. Psalm 63, verse 6, is not talking about a man who's up all night worrying. Not at all. Psalm 63 verse 6 tells us of someone who in the night watches is meditating on God. It's God that's filling his mind. It's not his trouble. It's not his difficulties. It's not his problem. It's God. He doesn't say, "I'm worrying about all the situations." He doesn't say, "I've got an ear out for Absalom's army coming up the hill." He doesn't say, "I'm having I'm unable to sleep." He doesn't say even, "I'm praying about my problems all night." He doesn't say that, does he? He simply says, "I meditate on you in the night watches." So if you find yourself in the situation of David in Psalm 63 and verse 6, and you don't have this glorious blessing of being able to lay your head on your pillow and switch off from the difficulties that you're facing and be able to trust God, maybe there are other things that keep you awake. Maybe you're waiting for a phone call of some crisis that's currently happening. Maybe it's simple it simply pain that's keeping you awake or some such thing? And in those situations, well, David here meditates on God in the night watches. So those of you who are able to sleep, well, what a glorious blessing. Those who are unable to sleep, well, you can learn from David in Psalm 63 rather than Psalm 3 and use those waking, painful, difficult hours to meditate on God. Now, I am not pretending by any stretch of the imagination that that will be easy, and I'm certainly not pretending that through my experience I'm able to give very much advice on that. I very much fall into the Psalm 3 category, as Sharon will testify, not the Psalm 63 category. But I do know many who are in exactly this situation and are helped by meditating on God in their difficulties and troubles. And it does help to put things into perspective. I don't know whether meditating on God actually lessens pain, but from what folk tell me, perhaps at least feels as though the pain is lessened and the difficulty subsides somewhat. Because you have been my help, then, verse 7, therefore in the shadow of your wings I will rejoice. So the picture of the shadow of the wings, the arms around, the comfort, the protection, he's going to rejoice in God. My soul follows close behind you, your right hand upholds me. So again, the contrast with verse 1. Early will I seek you, my soul thirsts for you, my flesh longs for you. That's the beginning of the day. The end of the day, I meditate you on the night watches because you have been my help. My soul follows close behind you. So here, David's early morning prayers and his late night thanksgiving for all the way in which God has upheld him. And it's very clear to see, isn't it, that God is both his desire, verses 1 to 4, and his delight, verses 5 through to 8. And finally then, from verses 9 through to 11, God, my defense. God, my defense. Because in all of this, he wants to be realistic. He wants to get those things in balance. He doesn't want to tip over one way or the other. He needs a big God, but he wants to acknowledge his big problems as well. And therefore, verses 9 and 11, he deals with his difficulties face to face. He confronts his difficulties point blank in verses 9 to 11, but he does so in a gloriously godly way. Verse 9, those who seek my life to destroy it shall go into the lower parts of the earth. I'll stop there and I'll come back to verses 10 and 11 in a moment, because verse 9 just illustrates exactly what we're trying to say of David. He doesn't ignore his problems, those who seek my life. Now, I don't know about you, but if I had a top 10 list of problems, that would be pretty near the top, were it true. It's a pretty major difficulty, isn't it? Somebody, actually a whole army, is trying to kill me. That's pretty major. People want to destroy me. It's a big problem. He's realistic about it. But he's realistic about it in a godly way, do you see? And he knows that those people who seek his life, those people are in the wrong. Those people are unjust. Those people are wicked. Those people are sinful. And he has the glorious advantage of knowing that as God's anointed, he's a king. That those who therefore seek to destroy the king are really not just rebelling against the king, but they're rebelling against the God who placed the king in that position. You remember David's attitude to Saul. It didn't matter what happened, David would not strike Saul because he was the Lord's anointed. And that understanding that David had through all those early difficulties now is a glorious help to him here, because he understands therefore that it's a wicked thing to seek to destroy the king, and therefore he knows that God is on his side because he is righteous, and therefore those who oppose him are opposing God, and those who oppose God shall go into the lower parts of the earth. He understands who they are. They're not believers, they're not followers of God. Now, it's his righteousness, at least in this part, that helps him to see that. You see, if David wasn't following after God, then those who opposed him might actually be on God's side, mightn't they? It's only because David knows that he is definitely on the Lord's side, it's only because David knows he's definitely doing what God wants, that he knows that those who oppose him must be wicked men. He only knows that because of his righteousness, which means David's holiness is the crucial thing in order to give him the assurance here that he is protected by God. Because if he's living an unholy life, as he's experienced himself at various points where he has sinned, he cannot rely on God for care. He could only do it because of his own righteousness. Well, verse 10 then, they shall fall by the sword, they shall be a portion for jackals. So verse 9, he's given encouragement over a lifetime, as it were, that these people are destined for hell, in essence. But verse 10 brings it more immediately, they shall fall by the sword, they shall be a portion for jackals. And in other words, David is able to span the whole of his life and the lives of those who oppose him in his prayer. But then verse 11 really helps to round things off, and again gives us that glorious balance that we've been talking about all along. So he's got his problems, but he's got his God. But the king, reminding himself of the office to which God has called him, and therefore the place where he's being protected, but the king shall rejoice in God. Everyone who swears by him, that's God, shall glory, but the mouth of those who speak lies shall be stopped. So again, you see that glorious balance. Great problems, but a great God. Now, every one of us here, the very obvious and simple application, every one of us here has a variety of different problems. Some of us have very small problems and minor problems. Some have much greater problems. Others will think that they have very big problems, but in 5 years down the line, they'll look back at now and think, oh, it was very easy then in 2008 compared with what I'm suffering now. You never quite know, do you? These things are often relative. But whatever category you fall into, we need to know that God is able to deal with whatever problems and with whatever difficulties are currently facing us or will face us in the future. And the priority for every one of us in our problems is to do as David did, and in this he's a glorious example, to seek the face of God and to find our comfort and our strength in him. Now, David didn't do that to the exclusion of taking practical steps in order to solve his difficulties. We looked last time, didn't we, about the spies that David sent in Jerusalem, and of course the march that is going on and the planning for the battle, all that's happening. David's not one to put up his feet, pray, and think that God will deal with everything. Not at all. David is a man of action, and he knows that God wants men of action. But what David is doing whilst he's acting and in his action is he's seeking the face of God. He doesn't separate the two. It's always both with David. It's always both. And this is the great lesson for every one of us. To deal with our difficulties through practical help, but through an earnest seeking of God, knowing that God will indeed help us, that God probably is already helping us, even though we haven't seen his hand, and trusting him, and never letting the problems appear bigger than our God. So God my desire, God my delight, and God my defense.